Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
This is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up.
Now, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Welcome to the show and our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas. I am Paul Harris alongside Dennis Phillips. The Poker Players Championship is one of the most prestigious tournaments in the world with its $50,000 buy-in and its mix of eight different poker games. No Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Omaha, and six limit games. Seven-card stud high-low, deuce the seven, triple draw low-ball, Omaha eight or better, Raz, and Limit Hold'em. If you win the PPC, you are considered one of poker's elite. And on today's show, we've got three guys who've had amazing success in the PPC recently. We have David Gunslinger Bach, who won it 2 years ago, but was knocked out of this year's event, which, by the way, started on Sunday and is going on today, but David was knocked out yesterday. We'll also talk with Matt Glantz, who finished fifth in the PPC last year and third in 2008 at that famous Scotty Wynn versus Eric Lindgren final table. But our first guest is Brian Rast, who is the reigning champion of this event. In addition to a bracelet for a $1,500 pot limit hold'em event he got last summer when he beat Alan Kessler heads up, he won the 2011 Poker Players Championship. He also cashed last year in the 2500 eight-game event. A very good summer for Brian here at the Rio. His earlier WSOP record includes another final table and four other cashes. Brian, welcome back to our final table.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. It's good to be here.
How excited are you to come to the WSOP each summer, particularly this year? What's it like for you walking back in here?
I'm pretty excited. You know, I'd love to follow it up and win another bracelet this year. I mean, that would be great. You know, whenever I come to WSOP, I'm always unsure how many tournaments I'm going to play because I'm primarily a cash game player. I feel like I make more money in cash games, and you know, kind of at the end of the day, that's what I do poker for.
Yep.
It's the type of thing I always walk in a little like, oh, I don't know how many tournaments I'm going to play. Like, people ask me for their fantasy drafts and stuff like that, and it's tough. But I'm always excited because, like, no matter what, there's always the main event. There's always a couple tournaments you end up playing. There's always everybody here, all the people you've met over the years. So it's always a good time. Like, just, it's an exciting time, although I'm never sure exactly what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, this year I'm pretty sure I'm going to play the 50K, although I'm a little disappointed because I've heard it's not televised, and because of that, the final table is not going to be No Limit Hold'em.
Right.
Correct.
Which some people are, I'm sure, happy about, but I'm actually a little sad because No Limit Hold'em is, that was like a little bit of an advantage for me.
You got your edge there?
It's my, No Limit Hold'em and Pot Limit Omaha are definitely my strongest games. And so the fact that the whole tournament was mixed games, but then you have a final table of No Limit Hold'em, for me, I thought that was to my advantage. And of course, it's fun having it being televised, but I kind of wonder whether or not that'll make the number of people drop out. Like, yep. Those two things, because there's a lot of people, I think, who did the tournament who are kind of like from my background, like people who are younger, like, but play mostly No Limit Hold'em, probably have played some PLO, have played the mixed games, but aren't super excited about putting 50K up in something like that. But because it's televised and because the final table was No Limit Hold'em, like, they play that event. But now that you're taking that away, I kind of wonder whether or not the number of people will go down this year. But
I think that's a good analysis, and I think you're probably right. It will go down some.
Yeah.
Question for you. What is your criteria to select a tournament then? I mean, is it that you walk in there and there isn't a good cash game going, so then you're going to check the schedule, or is it the reverse? You look at the tournaments first. They've got some new ones this year. They did the mixed match.
I looked at that one and was like, wow, that sounds exciting. And actually, there was a 3K half heads-up, like heads-up, half No Limit, half PLO. I didn't get back in time.
Yeah.
But I like definitely would have done that one. I mean, usually what I do is if there's not good cash games, I'll play tournaments.
Okay.
You know, like once 100, 200 or bigger blind PLO starts, I pretty much don't play many tournaments. I'll even sometimes miss 10Ks and stuff for those.
Mm-hmm.
If the cash games are smaller, it kind of goes like if there's a tournament that day that looks kind of fun, like any of these, like this 5K mixed match or you know, anything, I'll oftentimes play the tournament instead of the cash games. There's always like a 2550 or sometimes a 2550-100 PLO that goes here. That's like a pretty good alternative, but oftentimes it's not the best game always. It's a lot of regular PLO players, and sometimes I'll play smaller tournaments instead of playing that. Just because, I mean, even though I feel like my earn might be a little better in that cash game, it's, I mean, you do it for fun sometimes too. I mean, I play cash games all year, so sometimes if it's close, I'll go with fun and play a tournament, you know.
Last year there was a PLO game here that kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I think it started at 100, 200, 500, then it went 250, 500, 1,000. I think at some point it got even bigger than that. Were you playing in it when it got to its cap?
I played in it, I think, two times. The thing is, there were a group of the guys, they played it six-handed, and it was like Keto and a couple other people, and they all like started the game. And basically what happened is after they started it, it's in a casino, so like anyone could go on the list. But it was kind of like, I mean, there's obviously a lot of people who wanted to play it. And so because it was only six-handed, it got hard to get in the game. Yeah. You kind of had to just get lucky,
and
sort of.
What were they playing? What was the game?
It was PLO.
Yeah. What stakes?
I think when I played, it was 250, 500, 1,000 was when I played.
Wow.
But, I mean, like sometimes people got stuck, and there are people that like straddling a lot when they're stuck, and I mean, you know, the game could play bigger, but no, it was, I mean, it was a very good game, and I mean, if I could play in that game, I wouldn't play any tournament, like I would play that, but like, you know, it's, you know, that game, like I said, it's not that it was private, but they started it as a group, and a lot of them would stay and play, and if a guy dropped out and the others kept playing, then like people would come in if they got on the list, but it wasn't easy to get in the game if you weren't in that initial starting group.
Gotcha.
You know, like the one time I really got to play a decent, like a little bit of a session in the game is for whatever reason, I like was up at like 7 a.m. and because it was pretty dead, there was like, I came down here and I was like first on the list and somebody quit and I got to play for like 2 hours when it was pretty big. It was like 1,000 with people straddling and whatever for like 2 hours before the game broke. And I actually had a pretty decent win, But so that was nice.
Well, I got so many questions to ask. I'm going to jump around a little, so I'll apologize right now. But you've been over in Macau playing, correct?
Yeah, I have.
Most of our listeners hear about it but don't know anything about it. Can you give us, like, three positive things, three negative things? What are you going to go back? Did you enjoy it? You know, what's it like over there?
So the positive things are, you know, there are some big poker games that are good. They take place at a casino, so you don't really have to worry about a lot of the things you'd have to worry about, like maybe cheating or just not getting invited to like a, well, that's not necessarily true. And in private games, the invitation thing, the big game there is like kind of invited. You basically have to be invited to play. So, you know, it's also, it's like a pretty nice area for China. I mean, it's one of the more wealthy areas of China. You know, it was like used to be a Portuguese colony, and now, so kind of like Hong Kong, there's a lot more money there than in China. In fact, actually, like in Macau, in the right now, there's 5 times the amount of recorded gambling action that happens in Macau casinos than in Vegas casinos.
Yeah,
and it is the gambling capital of the world now. And by the way, there's a lot more unrecorded gambling action that happens there. So I mean, it's just like, and they're building. They're building casinos like they were in Vegas 5 years ago, just like things popping up. There's a new strip that's on like another island called Taipa, and they're just new resorts are popping up. The Wynn's building a new resort. I mean, like that's where the big boys are like putting their money right now, like Steve Wynn and all those guys. They're like, they don't give a shit about Vegas. They care about Macau.
Yep.
And I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with poker. It's just like the Asian gambling culture, it's like more, gambling is a bigger thing there. I mean, the negative things about it is the big game over there, you have to be invited. So you can go there with money, and if you're ready to play, like you stay there for a while, you might be able to ingratiate yourself in and get an invite. But the truth is there's a decent number of people over there now who are like kind of have that idea, and like there's already people that play. And another thing is some of the Chinese guys are a little bit homophobic, sort of. And maybe not homophobic, but the truth is, like, they don't really speak English. And it's like they don't, for the most part, want to play with, like, white pros who kind of, like, don't speak their language, you know? And I think they, some of them maybe feel uncomfortable when guys are speaking another language at the table they don't understand. Some of it's like a status thing. Like they got, a lot of the guys are like big money, like important Chinese guys, and like, you know, it, you're sort of like part of getting into the game for them, especially the bigger game, is like you're kind of somebody in that city. And like, you know, they're not like that excited to play with like kind of a white poker bum guy from America who's there just to like take their money.
Yeah, you know? I've heard from other people who've been over there that it's just not a fun trip. It can be a profitable one. There's good games if you can get them, but it's not fun at the table. That the guys don't interact. They're very solemn. You know, is that the case? I mean, it's more of a business trip.
I wouldn't say that's the reason why it's not fun. I think it's not fun because for the most part, there's nothing to do in Macau. Like there's just right. Macau's. I mean, it's like decent, but there's not a lot to do. It's not. I don't like love being there. I don't like love being in China particularly. I don't like Chinese food really. It's like noodly and oily and a lot of pork. And I just, I would say those are more of the reasons why I actually, a lot of the guys are pretty solemn at the table, but some of them kind of like speak a little of like whatever English they know. Well, we'll talk with you, especially if you make a little bit of an effort to say a few things in Chinese, like they obviously like that. And I mean, I don't know. I kind of, you know, every poker player likes playing with bad players, but I love playing with the guys that like kind of get in there and gamble and like bluff. Cause it's like just so much fun to figure out what they're doing. Cause you know, they just guys that play goofy and whatever. And you know, so I actually have fun playing in those games. Like, I don't mind it. One annoying thing is smoke. If you don't like smoking at the table, people smoke there and they do it at the table. Ooh. And it can be tough if it really bothers you. I mean, my lungs are a little sensitive, and when I'm there for a little while, sometimes it bothers me. So it can be rough.
I can remember the days of playing in smoky casinos here in the United States and having to bring a little fan to the table and point it at the guy who was smoking that cigarette. There were times when he'd put the cigarette down on his ashtray and I'd point the fan at it and smoke that cigarette for him, you know, make that thing burn as fast as I possibly could. Of course, all I did was reach in and get another one. But I can't imagine what it would be like to go back to that environment. It's just, you know, the haze after a while gets in your eyes and your lungs and all that sort of stuff. But I guess when you win a $1.2 million pot, that makes up for the smoke a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, obviously winning, the point of the trip is to win money, and like I like playing poker, so I don't mind going over there for reasonable sized doses. You know, and I think a lot of those guys are actually coming over here to play the $1 million for one drop tournament.
Yeah.
So they'll be around Vegas. I mean, and these guys are like big time gamblers. Like, who knows, they could be playing games here in Vegas, or I mean, I'm sure they're going to be kind of like private-ish type games where they invite, like they know who's going to play and invite. So, but I mean, you know, it could occasionally guys might spill over and play whatever. I mean, it'll definitely be good for like the poker thing. I mean, and the guys like love playing poker. I mean, when those guys play, it's like they'll play for days. And I mean, like one of the kind of like unwritten rules, if you're one of like the white pro guys that gets to play, is like you just don't quit.
Really?
Like you just can't, like you can't be like, oh, you played 8 hours and had a win and you quit. No, if you're losing, no one cares, right? Because I mean, you lost. But if you're winning, like especially, you're like kind of expected to play.
Wow.
So I mean, okay. I actually don't play as much as like, other friends of mine who I know, but like, you know, they're like, yeah, like if they're win, they'll just play. I mean, it's a good game, but some of them like. Some people don't like playing for, like, more than a day.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, probably. I mean, so, you know, like, it's a little uncomfortable. But, I mean, it's part of the, you know, there's a little give and take in any kind of relationship, right? So it's one of those things. You're one of the few people that has kind of been chosen to get to play in this game. And, like, that's what there is expected of you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it all no limit? Is there any mix in there with some PLO or something like that?
The big game that happens at Star World is all no limit. But
okay.
I believe there is like a Pot Limit Omaha game that's pretty big that goes there. I haven't played in it. That happens also with like a slightly different group of players. But I'm not sure because I haven't played in the Omaha game.
We were talking earlier about how we have not seen Tom Dwan here yet at the Rio yet, and speculating that perhaps he's over there in Macau where things are perhaps more profitable for him than coming here and playing in some of the early events of the WSOP.
Yeah, Tom is over there right now. It's hard to come back over here and play like 2K tournaments when you're playing like the one of the biggest games in the world, right?
Yeah, 2K, you know? That's my and big blind.
Tom is actually the guy that gets to play the most out of all like the white guy pros, basically. He's like allowed to play in games where he's like the only one, basically.
Wow.
Like I think there's a guy that doesn't exactly like playing with other pros, but he'll like let Tom play. And I mean, Tom gambles in there. I mean, like, you know, he gives a lot of action. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's some of them call him a fish. They're like, oh, fish. They make like little fish. Tom, yeah, come play, you know.
Really?
So, like, you know, I mean, it's
wow.
Which is funny. It's just funny to walk somewhere and like see people calling Tom a fish, you know, because like on this side of the world, like no one really thinks of him that way.
Right.
But I mean, and I don't know like how much of it's a joke and how much of it's not. Obviously, yeah. They know he knows what he's doing sometimes, but there'll definitely times where they'll see him make a play and they're like, what are you doing? Like, why did you just ship it with the 9-high flush draw? You know, like there,
mm-hmm.
you know, like for 100 big blinds. Because, like, the guys aren't, you know, they kind of, like, know what's going on. They talk about the hands. Like, they care. Like, they, like, love playing. Like, you know, they're rich guys who could do a lot of things and like gambling but play poker, like, 40-hour sessions. Like, they obviously love the game. So, you know.
Yeah, but successful people that are CEOs, people that have made millions, are also normally very, very competitive.
Right. Yeah.
And this is a competitive game. They're not going to sit down there and, you know, just nonchalantly play this. I would bet it's very intense at times at that table.
Yeah, it's very intense. So, yeah.
So who are the other white Americans who are going over there to play besides you and Tom?
You know, I've heard a lot of guys. I mean, I've heard Gus is over there. I've heard Andrew Robles over there. Who else? There's some guys from Europe, like Andy Mosley, a guy named Oystein.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? A friend of mine, Keith Gibson's over there sometimes. You know, there's probably some other people I'm forgetting.
How often do you go, and how often would you be going back?
I've been there twice this year. You know, I don't know. Like, part of I go when I can. You know, I have like a family now, and it's not always the easiest for me to go to plan a trip to Macau,
mm-hmm.
you know, because
it's the other side of the world. If you're going to go, you're going to spend at least a couple of weeks there, I would think. So
you know, like my wife and our son are still getting acclimated to America. You know, like she still can't drive, so it's not the easiest for me to like plan that stuff right now.
Right.
But you know, I you know, I think I'm kind of at a spot where I sometimes have access, and it's like worth it for me to go. So I try to go when I can.
It doesn't sound like it's a family vacation place.
No.
So,
I mean, like, it's not really.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's actually because it was a Portuguese colony. My wife is Brazilian. She speaks Portuguese. So there's a little bit of, like, Portuguese culture. It's actually surprisingly small amount of people actually speak Portuguese. But she kind of likes going for some of that stuff. And just she kind of likes it there, actually more than Vegas.
All right. Well, let's talk about something. I think you were a valedictorian in your class.
Yeah.
You went to Stanford. What did you major in? How did that help you in poker? Why did you go to poker then? You probably had a promising potential career here somewhere, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, in high school, I basically kicked ass in school. I mean,
okay.
I did a really good job. I got like a 1560 on my SATs or 1550, something like that. Did it like I was just crushing it.
Yeah.
And I love school. I like kind of was involved with my friends. Like, all my friends were in my classes. We'd hang out, like, play basketball, study, play video games after school, whatever. It was, like, pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
I went to college. I, like, started to have the whole crisis of, like, what exactly am I doing? Like, why am I learning this stuff? Like, you know, it got to the point where in high school it was, like, cool, I'm doing this with my friends. I'm going to go to college. That's why I'm doing it.
You had a purpose. You know?
I mean, it was a purpose. Maybe it wasn't, like, ultimately the best purpose, but I knew I was just going to go to college. Mm-hmm. But after college, it's like, well, I'm going to get a job. And then so I started to struggle a little bit. I started smoking a little pot, maybe. You know, I just, like, started trying new things in life.
Sure.
Like, I wouldn't say that's the whole reason, but and then I was a little unmotivated. I was doing math, although I was a pretty terrible math major. I chose it pretty late. it was kind of half-hearted. I actually wish I chose something else in retrospect. I being good at math helps at poker.
Mm-hmm.
College level math doesn't matter at all for poker.
Yeah.
I mean, poker's like
linear analysis. Yeah,
yeah,
here
doesn't matter.
Calculus and pot odds are not in the same discussion.
Yeah, what matters for poker math for the most part is just being able to do things quickly, estimate quickly.
Yeah.
Like, so you know, being good at math helps with that. You know, if you're bad at math, you're not going to be estimating quickly or doing like quick calculations fast in your head. It'll take you a while. But you know, the stuff that you need for that doesn't matter. But basically, I found poker in college, and like once I started playing poker, I like started making some money, and I always loved playing games. Like I played strategic video games, I played like Risk, Axis and Allies, all kinds of strategy games like Command and Conquer, whatever. Like I played Hearts, Spades, Chess. I just always played strategy games and stuff. So I even like my freshman year in college, I played this Counter-Strike. It's like a first-person shooter where I ran like this clan like four times a week, and I came up with our match strategies and. And, like, you know, I didn't make any money at it, so I had to quit. But then once I started making money at poker, I was like, you know what? I think I'm just going to do this. And, like, once I kind of found something that I knew I wanted to do, I was going to make money at, I just was like, well, what do I need school for? And then so I ended up dropping out. I wanted to finish sort of in part because, you know, I had my parents telling me, well, I mean, my dad always talked with me reasonably about it. My dad's, like, that kind of person. I respect them a lot for it. You know, he didn't, like, demand, like, oh, like, you need to do this. He'd be like, listen, Brian, you know, you're going to one of the best schools in the country. Poker might not work out. Like, I believe you could win at it. I think you can do, you know, anything you put your mind to. But like, why don't you just finish up school and, like, get your degree, and then you'll always have that as a fallback. Whereas if you drop out, like, it'll be hard, maybe hard for you to go back in the future. I mean, like, it made a lot of sense.
That is pretty logical.
It's pretty logical.
But you said, but, Dad, I saw Rounders.
No. What I said was like, no, what happened is like because I would go home and talk with him, I'd like go back to school. But it's like it's one thing to like believe it when you're talking with your dad at home. It's another thing to go to school and for like 12 weeks of a quarter, like, I don't know, go to class and do something you don't care about. Like I just couldn't, like when I was there during the course of that, I would just stop going to class, play poker, hang out with people and like. You know, by the end, I actually, my last quarter there, I just failed all my classes because I literally, like, just quit.
Lost the motivation.
So, yeah. And then I, and at some point I realized, like, well, hey, as much as I'd like to do this, the result right now is that I'm on probation. I'm, like, wasting my parents' money. And, like, I have, like, a kind of beginning of a successful poker career maybe. And, like, I'm just going to do it and, like, you know, apologize to my parents and move on with my life.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
And it's successful. You've done well, obviously, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, you can dangle some bracelets in front of your parents and say, hey, not bad.
Well, I'll tell you, when I started playing poker, I did not think I was going to do as well as I was. I kind of assumed I was giving up money to, like, have a life where I worked for myself and played a game and, like,
and enjoyed
what I did and didn't answer to anybody.
Yeah.
Now, in the end, maybe I didn't really give up money. Who knows? Because I've, like, done better than I thought. And poker's bigger than I thought, like, it was, you know. But, like, yeah, that's... So that's it was nice.
So here at the WSOP, you talked earlier about how you're probably going to play. You're going to play the 50K, and you're certainly going to be in the main event. Are you playing smaller events and things like this weekend? On the first weekend of the WSOP, they're having this $1,500 buy-in re-entry event, which I think is the first time they've done it here. They've done it on the circuit, and other tours have done it as well. But it's the first re-entry event at the WSOP. What do you think of re-entry events like this?
You know, I think it's a good idea. I mean, I like anything that makes prize pools bigger. I actually liked rebuy tournaments. I wish they brought back. I mean, I know people, there's the side of people that say, oh, like people are trying to buy a bracelet. You know what? I like it when someone just shoves all in at the beginning of a tournament and like Phil Ivey goes in for 40 buy-ins. I mean, why not? I mean, I know like maybe it gives him an advantage in getting a bracelet. But if you're playing the tournament, I mean, this guy's like, giving you free money essentially for playing.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know what? I do think that bracelets are valuable and there should be some sort of protection of them, but like I like the idea of rebuys. I'm okay with the idea of re-entry, you know? So that's how I feel about it. I'm okay with
Dennis
it.
Dennis and I were actually talking about this yesterday, and I told him my two thoughts on it are, first, I'm only going to buy in once. So if you buy in twice, I have an overlay from you, and I thank you for that. The other thing is, on day 1A, because people know they could go to 1B and re-enter, just like you were talking about before in the rebuy event, I think people do get it in worse much more often. They're much more willing to get all their chips in on draws and that sort of stuff.
Which for sure, 100%.
Oh, especially late at night.
Yeah.
Those last couple of levels when people don't want to come back short stack, they'd rather rebuy.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, there's some shoving going on.
Oh, no, there
it's like
be
a maniac.
Sure. Because people want to build up big stacks and like have a chance to really like dominate and win the tournament. And so especially if it's a guy who's like the 1500 is a small buy-in for him,
mm-hmm.
and like you're late in the day and you have starting stack or less, it's like, why wouldn't you just gamble? Because you just buy in the next day if you wanted to play it again.
So here's our question for our listeners who, you know, don't have big bankrolls and they may be weekend warriors and they're going to come out to the WSOP for the first time and they want to play one event, so on the weekend they're going to play in a 1500. Is it better for them to play on 1A where you're going to have more of that shoving, but it also means you got to walk over more mines in the minefield? Or should they play 1B, which might play a little bit more like a regular tournament?
1A.
You say 1A, why?
Without hesitation. The truth about poker is this. You make money when your opponents make minus EV decisions. And if you have people making minus EV decisions for other reasons, like I want to build up a big chip stack where I can buy in tomorrow.
100%.
Then, like, you are making money from that at the table. Because, like, you know, you're the benefit of the guy getting it in on 30% with you or whatever. And, I mean, true, yeah, you could bust. But, I mean, that's, you know, you make money in poker by having plus EV spots. And, like, you know, those are plus EV spots. And that's how you build up big chip stacks. I mean, let me put it this way. To win a tournament, you have to get lucky. What's easier, getting lucky three times in 50-50s or in 70-30s?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, I'll take 70-30s. Sure, you're still probably going to be out after 70-30s. But you're more likely to be out after 50-50s.
Yep. Yep.
So, I mean, like, that's, you know, if you're going to win a tournament, you have to get lucky. You might as well get lucky against people playing bad. 1A.
Absolutely.
Final answer.
All right. There you
I
go.
I like that.
Some great
Very
advice
well
from a man who won two bracelets last year and wants to get another, at least one more this year. And we wish you the best of success in that. It's really always a pleasure talking to you, Brian. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Brian Rass joining us here at the final table with our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris on the final table on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. Don't forget our podcasts are downloadable via iTunes and Stitcher Radio and via our show website, FinalTableShow.com. This is our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris along with Dennis Phillips, and we're joined now by David Gunslinger Bach, a guy born in Missouri, lived one entire year there before moving on to California and then to Georgia. Now splits his time between Georgia and Panama and his brand new home in Las Vegas. We had David on the show in February, shortly after he finished third in the PCA 8-game championship. And then he flew down to the Aussie Millions and won the 2,500 horse event, which was his second horse ring down under. 3 years ago here at the WSOP, he won the biggest horse event of them all, the 50K Poker Players Championship. And last summer, he finished 45th in the main event, cashed in three others, including third in the 2,500 Deuce to 7 Lowball event, and second in the 5K PLO 8 event. You could say he's a mixed game specialist. We're happy to have you back at the final table. David, good to see you.
Great to be back on the show again. I love this show.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. It's nice to see you. You bought a house right before the WSOP was starting. Are you a crazy person?
You know, the plan was to close on it 6 weeks before the series, have everything configured. I got a great place to move into. I love the place. It's right behind the Aria Poker Room and 2 minutes from the Rio. But we closed a week before the World Series, and getting cable and internet and all that stuff has been a small nightmare.
Because you have so much free time now.
Yeah.
Nothing to do, only playing a little bit of poker or something like that every now and then.
80, 90 hours a week.
A minor little thing.
Wow.
We ought to mention the Aria, too, and going on over there. I understand you play there quite a bit?
I do. It's, it's bar none my favorite poker room in Las Vegas. Had a lot of bad experiences at Bellagio over the years. I'm sure that won't be new to people. And, of course, there's some nice people there. But the Aria has just been first class. The four people could not be nicer. I'm good friends with Adam, the poker room manager. The dealers are top-notch, and they've just done everything they can to make it a really pleasant experience.
And you're wearing their logo, we should point out, which may be the only way American players can get endorsed by any kind of poker organization.
That's all it is. It's not much. It's yeah, if we can get a candy bar these days, we're doing good.
You got a shirt and a hat. That's not bad.
True.
I mentioned that you're living part-time in Panama. Your girlfriend is from there, and when we talked to you in February, you were on the phone from Panama. Which means you're part of the international online community of Americans who left the country to try to find other places to continue to play online. How is that? And how is it playing online without the American players?
Well, for me, being online in Panama was just... I was with my girlfriend for 4 years. I'm down there all the time anyway, so why not get an account while I'm there?
Okay.
I've never been much of an online player. I'm probably a small lifetime winner. I won a Sunday Million and a few other tournaments. But the games are terrible. If you want to play mixed games above, like, $4 and $8, the games are just full of professionals. They're really tough to beat. The tournaments are lucrative, but, you know, when I go down to Panama, it's to be with my girlfriend and have a good time and relax and get away from poker. So I might play once every 2 weeks. It's not really anything exceptional.
Well, hopefully things are going to change, and the U.S. will be back into the mix, and things will go back to what it was pre-Black Friday. That may be a while down the road. You have a house here in Vegas. You're here for the WSOP. Life must be pretty good right now. You've had a good run here for the last couple of years.
Yeah, so. The pokers could not have been better. I have a really funny story to tell you guys.
All right.
If you got just a minute. I'm driving across the country, and I'm taking my two cats from Georgia to Las Vegas, and I'm a big Lakers fan. I stop in Oklahoma City and go to the basketball game. I happen to time it right to go see it. So I go into the game, watch the game. The Lakers blow an 8-point lead, lose the game they shouldn't have lost. I come back out to get my car, and my car had been towed.
Oh.
I parked in, like, this dirt parking lot where there were, like, 300 cars. They decided to tow the 10 cars that were closest to the exit, and with no signs saying you can't park here or any of that kind of stuff. The bad part is my cats were in the car. Now, they were fine. It was 72 degrees at tip-off. They were fine in the car. But animal control sees the cats, so they end up taking the cats to animal control, and my car goes to another place. I can't find out where my car is. Eventually, I call 911, find out my cats are in animal control. I go to the towing place, and you see this guy was like a stereotypical, you know, 400-pound tow truck guy that you would think of from Oklahoma.
Yep.
And so I go to get my car, planning to go get the cats next. I go to my car, and one of my cats, the younger one, is sitting right there in the window. He was smart enough. He hid out from the cops. He hid under the seat. I'm so proud of this cat.
Uh-huh.
And then the next morning, I go to animal control. I get his brother. And the little one was so happy to actually be alone. He got rid of his bullying big brother. But I got them both. I got back on the road. It was a heck of an adventure driving across the country.
Wow.
It just reminds me of the, what was the animation, Cars, with Nader, the tow truck guy.
Mater.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
Joe Mater.
It must have been Mater's brother then.
It's got 400 pounds, the overalls, the whole bit, everything you would think of in a movie. Yeah.
So here's a lesson we can pass along to you kittens listening in today. Always hide under the seat.
What a brilliant cat.
All right. Everybody has a different background for poker. Your dad, I think, was a psychologist.
Yeah.
And when you studied at the University of Georgia, it was in?
In psychology.
In psychology. Yeah. Has that helped you, you think, at the table?
Oh, a bunch. I'm not the most technically sound poker player in the world. You can ask anybody. Yeah. And I show up with bad hands all the time. But I have a really good feel for what's going on at the table, what kind of mood people are in, and therefore, you know, whether they're a little tilted, they're going to play differently than they normally would. If I'm in the zone, I could really kind of tell what's going to happen before it happens.
Awesome. So is that because you're seeing maybe tells you don't even realize are tells?
Yeah, if you just pay attention, sometimes you just pick up things you don't even know you're picking up. And, you know, you see somebody just, you know, just kind of disgusted and, you know, mm-hmm. How they're going to react to that.
Okay, cool. Well, we talk about tells all the time and the different standard ones, and we've read the books and the whole bit. Do you have any particular ones that you look for or anything in particular you try and catch up of a person? Or
it's very different with different people. It's really just a case of paying attention. Of course, you know, at the World Series, you're going to get a lot more tells. Amateurs give off tells. You know, some of them are just crazy. Usually with the professionals, you're not going to – it's not a tell that you're picking up. It's just kind of a general mood overall. It's kind of game flow, I guess, would be probably the best way to describe it.
And perhaps some bet sizing comes in. So it's not physical tells, but what they're doing in certain circumstances that you've seen them do earlier or not seen them do earlier.
Very much so. Very important, yeah.
Yeah. This is a part of the game that doesn't get talked about enough, which is remembering what's happened at the table. And when you play in big tournaments, you know, whether it's 5 to 7,000 people in the main event or even in a smaller mixed game event that still has hundreds of people in it, how do you keep track of what you're seeing and what you're not seeing and remembering this guy I played at a table with 2 days ago and this is what he did in that situation?
I seem to have a natural ability for that. It's, you know, I was teaching one of my friends poker a couple years ago, and he was watching me play online, and I was just kind of going through things, and I said, well, this guy did this a while back. It was like a half hour. He's like, how did you remember that? Because I can't remember a grocery list. but for some reason, I can remember what's going on at the table, even, you know, things from a few years ago.
Yeah.
I guess it's just I have a passion for the game probably is a lot of it.
Well, a lot of times, too, a hand may stick in your mind for some particular reason. I had a guy about a month ago come up to me. We played a tournament at the Venetian. He said, you probably don't remember me. You know, I was in there in hand. I won a monster hand one time. I said, yeah, you had the Jack 9 of diamonds.
Yeah.
And the guy looked at me, and his jaw drops down and says, how could you remember a hand like that? Well, because you were an idiot, frankly. you called a 4-bet out of position with a Jack 9 of diamonds when you had to know you were totally dominated, and then you caught the monster on the turn, and, you know, away you went. But I didn't remember him. I didn't remember anything about it except how poorly I thought it was played. So I couldn't tell him that. Well, now I have, I guess.
Well,
You get sometimes where you you'll be sitting there playing with somebody for maybe like a half hour, and then all of a sudden they'll do something, and it'll click, and you'll remember, oh, that's that guy I played with like
exactly.
a year ago. And then the whole picture comes together.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Or sometimes it's somebody you've been playing with for an hour at a tournament, and you see them doing something. If you're being observant, and we've pounded this on the show, how you got to be paying attention even when you folded your hand because stuff is going on at the table that you need to observe. I can remember last year playing in a tournament noticing that a guy was giving another, he had moved all in and he was giving the other guy a hard, hard stare. And the other guy finally cry called him, and the guy who was giving the hard stare was on a total bluff. Total air. I put that away in the memory bank. An hour later, I'm playing a hand against this guy. I'm pretty sure I've got him, but I'm going to pause, and I'm going to look up, and I usually don't look at people in these situations right in the eyes. I look up, and he's giving me the same hard stare. And I looked away because I want to get confirmation. I looked away, and then I looked back, and he's still staring at me. I snap called at that point, and sure enough, he had air.
Yeah,
that's the sort of stuff you got to look for that you got to be observant about at the table. And that's more than just what did he do just now? It's what did he do earlier that goes into the memory bank, right?
Yeah, of course.
Part of the time what can really, really be aggravating at the table is you think you have a read on the guy, but say in that situation with the guy staring and everything on the first time, but then the other one, he ends up not having to show his hand, so you're not for sure.
Right.
You can have a tell or you can have an idea how he plays, but until you can confirm it, it's just that. How many times have you sat at a table where somebody that looks like he's tight as can be in such a knit, but he's putting 3 bets out there and he's taking down pots, he's either catching tremendous cards or you've got a total misread on this guy, and he never shows his cards. And you're sitting there, somebody call him. You know, type of a thing.
I like to be that guy.
But you can, even if you don't ever get the complete information of seeing the cards, you've got a direction to go in. So if you've got a 50-50 situation, you got a direction you can swing.
Good point. Very good point. Yeah.
Speaking of tells, you're very good at not giving off tells to the point where I don't think I've ever heard you talk at the table.
It's funny. I was saying that to you guys before I came on the air. That's who I am. I talk a ton away from the table. I'm just not talkative at the table.
You don't even talk between hands. You're very quiet at the table because maybe it's because you're observing. Is it because you just plain aren't going to give anybody any information?
Not so much that, especially like in a limit event. It's not that I'm opposed to talking, but I have a lot of stuff going on that I'm trying to you know, how many chips does this guy have? What mood is he in? You know, I try and even pay attention between hands. Sometimes you can pick up things.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that Daniel does is he tries to engage, Daniel Negreanu tries to engage people and talk.
Great at that.
He claims he can pick up a lot of tells that way, and I don't doubt that he can. But, you know, he just tries to find out what your background is, what your job is, because are you an accountant or are you a car salesman? So then, you know, if you're an accountant, he thinks you play this way. If you're a car salesman, you play this way, you know, that type of stuff. And he engages people ahead of time. I have seen him sit down and try to talk to somebody who just literally will freeze up and not say a word to him because he's scared he's going to give something away.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, kind of funny.
It's probably something I could stand to do a little bit more of. I've thought about that over the years. I think I'd give away less than I would gain if I talked more.
I think you're pretty observant. I think in your background, you can analyze people pretty well. So,
one thing that I've noticed with myself, I'm sort of an attention deficit disorder type person.
Yep.
And one thing that I notice, if I get into conversations that aren't poker related, I'll end up, you know, enjoying the conversation, talking about basketball or whatever, and then I'm not paying attention to what's going on at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay in a cash game because you have plenty of time to observe the people. But in a tournament where you may only be with this guy for an hour, you need to get as much as you can in that first 10 or 20 minutes. You really have to pay attention.
As a mixed game specialist, I'm curious about what you think of the fewer numbers of 10K championships that there are. There used to be one for every kind of poker. Now, a stud doesn't have a 10K championship. Stud 8 doesn't have a 10K championship. PLO 8 doesn't. You're a mixed game guy. These are some of your games. They've knocked the buy-in down to 5K. They don't even call it a championship anymore. What do you think of that?
I'm not in favor of it. I do understand the reasoning behind it. The theory is that they're going to get double the entrance. You know, that's what Jack Heffel has said. If they got double the entrance, I'm all for it. If they got close to double the entrance, like 80% more. But if they only get like 30% more, now you're playing for a much smaller prize pool, and I'm definitely not in favor of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand. I get the reasoning behind it. We'll see how it works out.
All right. They've got several new versions here that they're doing different things. They're doing a 4-max. They're doing the one where you start out with a full ring down to a 6 and down to heads up. Are there any of the new ones that really catch your attention, any of them that you really like?
You know what I was just thinking about the other day? Why aren't they doing any of that with the mixed games? They're all still 8-handed.
Yeah.
And we enjoy that a lot in our mixed game community. We enjoy playing shorthanded. I'm all for like a 4-max hold'em. Why not have a 4-max 7-card stud tournament?
You know, I've never heard of anybody being a shorthanded or heads-up stud specialist.
I guess I might be that.
I was going to say, you could be the guy. That's why you want that tournament. Yeah. There aren't enough people who have the skills that you have.
Yeah.
We had a tweet from a listener named James Ferguson who said, could you please ask David for some advice on playing high-only hands in stud 8?
Ah, okay. I know a lot about this. I probably play them quite a bit more than most people do. The one big caution I would say is just beware of the ace. Those hands are fine to play if there's not an ace showing, but you don't want to get involved with the big pair when the ace is showing. Ace is such a powerful card in stud 8. Even if they don't have aces now, they can make aces later.
That makes sense.
And what about worrying about the guys who are in there with both the high and the low, and you got just the high, and you could end up being quartered? That's a real risk in high-only hands, right?
Well, that's where you have to play poker well. There's going to be times where you start out with that high hand, and you could get stuck in a spot where, you know, two people have really strong lows, and they're going to make it too expensive to stay in. But then there's other times where they're going to bust out, they're going to make two low pair, and your two big pair ends up winning the pot.
For anybody who's ever played in a home game, by the way, with all the crazy games that you play in, imagine playing 727 and two guys have 7 and you're working your way up towards 27.
Exactly.
And they're just pounding the pot, pounding the pot. That's exactly what he's talking about. The low and the high combined can just pound a pot against a guy who's just got a one-way hand. And now you're going to get crushed or quartered or worse.
And that's where I came from was home games in Atlanta. So we used to play Dealer's Choice. We'd play every game you could even invent.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that was a good background for adjusting and adapting to new games.
Yeah.
We talked to several people about the variants, the different games that are going on now, and how everybody is proficient at No Limit. Everybody, see, whatever table you sit down with, somebody or several people there play it very, very well.
Very
now, you
true.
Get into the mixed games. You get into the combinations. Where should a person go if they want to expand from No Limit? Do they go to the PLO? Do they go to somewhere else?
I think the draw games are the future.
Okay.
People are just loving Deuce to Seven Triple Draw, Badoogie, and now Badoosi and Badesi are just on fire. And I think if you can learn those games, they're just going to do nothing but get bigger. People love them. They're fun. You squeeze your cards out. You know, draw poker was originally the most popular form of poker for a reason.
Yep.
And I think that's where things are going to head away from No Limit.
But how are they going to learn it if they can't play online? You can't go to most casinos and play Low Limit Badoogie or Deuce to Seven Triple Draw.
Well, the Aria does have every day they spread like a 11 or 12 game mix at $8 and $16 limit. I mean, that's not nothing, but you can go in with a couple hundred bucks and play.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, online was how I learned Deuce to Seven Triple Draw. I started at $2 and $4 and worked my way up through the limits. That was just a few years ago, and now I feel like that's one of my better games.
Well, like in Horse or some of the different ones that way, we talked to Barry Greenstein, who said he'd go in there and he'd analyze his table and he'd find out who couldn't play what. And there might be a couple of players that really didn't know how to play Raz or a couple of, you know, for their week in one of the other aspects of it. And he said that's where you concentrate. You analyze the table, you find out who is weak in which games, and you pounce on those and build it up.
It's also important to know what your games are, whether you're strong in one discipline and weak in another, and you probably want to play more hands than the ones you're better at.
Oh, you should see the negotiating that goes on. And usually I'm playing 3 and 600 mixed, and the guys are just pushing so hard for their games and for the games they don't like. I try and take the attitude, I'm not going to let myself get run over, but I want to play everything. Because if I'm not good at a game, let's play it, and I'll try and get better.
Not a bad philosophy.
Before,
might be expensive.
some people may not know this, but before playing poker, David was a professional bowler for how many years?
Well, I guess I made all my money through college. So probably from like 18 to 23, 24. And I joined the Pro Tour later on when I was already an established professional poker player.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, it wasn't for money. I just wanted to pit myself against the best and see how I could do.
Could you still get on the alley?
Yeah, I still probably am. It would take a little physical exercise, frankly, to be able to bowl the grueling schedule on the tour. I mean, they bowl, you know, as many as like 16 games in a day.
Yeah.
So I would have to work out the physical muscles, too. But I think I could get to the back to the level I was
well,
at.
Well, here's why I asked. Lon McCarron, our friend who does play-by-play for the World Series of Poker on ESPN, just signed a deal to be the play-by-play guy for the PBA telecast for next season.
Oh, I'm thrilled about that.
So you could be the first guy that Lon gets to announce in both games, poker and bowling.
Wow. I'm thrilled about it. You know, I like the guy, Rob Stone, that was doing it before. He's a friend of Bill Simmons, who's one of my favorite sports writers. But to hear that Lon's going to be in bowling, that's super.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled about that. I'm sure he'll do a great job.
Wait, it's a step up from the, what was it he did one time, chess or something like that. He said the worst gig he had, I think it was chess.
Maybe darts.
No, he said he had to do. He had to give the play-by-play of a chess tournament.
Wow.
Think on that for a minute and how solemn they are and how long they take. Could you fill that area with some sort of, I mean, what are you going to start talking
about? Especially to be able to talk about it, you have to be a grandmaster of chess, which that's pretty hard.
You got to hope one of the guys, you got to hope one of the players is aggro.
There you go. Is there such a thing in chess?
There must be. There must be. So what's your plan for the WSOP? How many events do you think you're going to play? And will you concentrate in just mixed games?
I usually end up in the low 20s. And, yes, I do. I play every mixed game event that I have the stamina that I'm not already in some other tournament. I'll sprinkle some No Limit in there. And, yeah, usually I'll end up somewhere between 15 and 25. I actually hope for a lower number because that means I'm doing real well in the tournaments I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just be here every day and work as hard as I can. One thing really fun this year is I got to be in Daniel's $25,000 fantasy league.
Uh-huh.
I bought a quarter of a team with Josh Ari and a couple other guys.
Did you help choose who were
the players?
Oh, very
much so, yeah. I couldn't. I'm a control person. I could not have input.
Who were the people that you insisted were on the team?
Scott Seaver, who I just think the world of his play.
Just walked by here a few minutes ago. We said hi to him.
He's also playing the one-drop tournament, which is a big bonus. Because it's such a small field.
Yep.
George Lind, who I think a lot of his play. The rest of them, we kind of came to a collaboration with the rest of the team. Those are two guys I really love.
Is Scott going to play enough mixed game events during the series?
I think Scott's probably going to play every mixed game event, and he's going to play more No Limit than I will.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because when people do these drafts, sometimes they think of the famous No Limit Hold'em players or the ones that they've seen a lot on ESPN and on the old poker shows. And they, well, I know that name. Yeah, that guy's a great player. But if they're just a No Limit Hold'em player,
they're not good for the draft.
Yeah, you can't draft them because they're never going to play the stud events. They're never going to play the mixed game events. They're never going to play the PLO events. That's going to limit the amount of points you can get out of that player.
I'll tell you, Scott has gotten so good at the mixed games. I've played a lot with him in the last year. And he is really, he's first of all, he's just a great poker player.
Yep.
But secondly, he's really gotten good at all the games.
Well, the top three in most of the drafts, in varying orders, so there's no particular order here, have been Phil Ivey, Daniel Negron, and Jason Mercier. Do you agree with those three, or would you put Scott or somebody else ahead of them?
Jason Mercier I couldn't argue with. I think Scott is better than Negrano in the mixed games.
Okay.
Negrano doesn't, you know, he's a great spokesman for poker. He spends all his time promoting. But he doesn't play cash mixed games every day. Scott does.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be better.
Were you allowed to choose yourself in the draft?
I was. My teammates actually wanted me to bid a little more for me. And we had four slots left, and we only had $44 left. And we got up to 30 on me. And I was like, well, I don't want to get stuck with no other good picks. So I told them to cut us off. So Todd Brunson wound up buying me for 31.
Okay.
Okay. Well, can you give us a quick lowdown of your maybe – how many do you have in your team, first of all?
Eight people.
Can you give us the top three or four that you picked?
Give us all eight.
We took Scott Seaver at 62, which is actually a bargain, I think. It's as good as he is, and he's playing the million-dollar tournament. Our next highest number went to Justin Smith, Boosted J, for 40. Very good all-around player, also playing the million. Our next one was Scott Clements, who has over $5 million in earnings, plays the mixed game, plays all the games well. Then George Lind, who is just the ultimate grinder. You know, he's on top of the Scoop leaderboard every year for Poker Stars, and he played 38 events last year.
Wow.
And he plays well. Our next was Mike Gordinsky, who not too many people may know, but he plays all the mixed games in San Diego. I played a lot of poker with him. He's a good, well-rounded poker player. And then we had Ellie Elezra, who's some people discount because he's older. Ellie loves poker. He's here every day. He cares about that bracelet, and he's going to be working hard to get one. And we got him for $11.
Also a guy who plays mixed cash games.
Yes,
very much so.
And then the last two picks were guys that may not be too well-known by their actual names, but Lee Goldman, who is Enon online on Poker Stars, who's been killing the mixed games, and he said he's really excited about trying to get his first bracelet. And then Sebastian Sabic, who is Seb86. Unfortunately, I got news after the draft that he may not be coming till later in the series.
Mm.
I would have taken somebody else, obviously, if I'd known that.
Yeah.
But I respect his skills a lot. He went for $40 in last year's draft.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, cool.
Now, I have a friend who did a little home draft with some of his friends, and he picked Tom Dwan. And no one has seen Durr here. I'm pretty sure he's in Macau.
Of course he is.
You know, because you probably have to finish at the final table of a 10K event to make as much as he can make in one pot in Macau.
Also, I wonder what's going to happen with his bracelet bets. You know, some of them are with people like Howard Lederer.
Yeah.
Who can't be seen and probably is not, you know, in a great cash position right now.
Yeah, may not be able to pay off on that seven-figure bet.
Good point.
Yeah, I wonder if it got called off in light of all the Full Tilt stuff.
Entirely possible.
But he had one with Ivy, too, and Ivy's here playing.
Yeah.
Maybe Ivy sees that there's an overlay. If Tom ain't coming, I'll go.
You know, I think Ivy, he may not say it to anybody, but I think he really cares about the career numbers. And he's already put up some great numbers, and in his age, you know, he could end up, passing Helmut at some point.
Yep.
You know, you can't be the competitor that Ivy is and not care about that.
That's a great point.
Very good point.
That's a great point.
All right.
Well, David, we appreciate you stopping by and joining us again. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Enjoy your summer here. Good luck getting the cable put in. And,
I hope so.
And we'll keep an eye on you as the summer rolls along here at the WSOP.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure to be on the show. I'm happy to be back anytime. I love it. I listen to your podcasts all the time and really enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
Maybe I'll see you in the area.
I hope so.
All right.
Sounds great.
David Gunslinger Bach joining us here at the final table. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris at the Rio in Las Vegas with our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. Don't forget our podcast available via iTunes and Stitcher Radio and all the time on our website, FinalTableShow.com. This is our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker from the Rio in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris, sitting alongside Dennis Phillips and Matt Glanz, the mixed games specialist from the Philadelphia area, who last year made the final table of the $50,000 buy-in Poker Players Championship, also had four other caches here at the WSOP, and this year is back for more. Although, if you follow him on Twitter, you may know that he's been avoiding the Rio on certain days because the cash games at Aria and Bellagio have been just too big, right?
I wouldn't say I've been avoiding the Rio, but I've actually had some short stints in a couple tournaments. They had mostly 1500s for the first week, and you know, it's like hit or miss. Either you get chips early or you bust early with the structures there are. So I was busting early this week, so I was heading over to Bellagio and Aria and playing some cash games, and there happened to be big games. But I think there was only one day where I actually purposely skipped tournaments to play cash because it was a really good 800-1600 mixed game there, which is pretty big, bigger than normal, and the lineup was pretty good. So
does that mean that Phil Hellmuth showed up, and when he's there, you want to play cash?
No, he wasn't in that game. I played with Phil this week. I think we were playing 4-8, a couple draw games mixed at the Aria, but the game I was talking about was a bunch of East Coast guys that I play with back home sometimes, and they were out here playing 800-1600, two studs. Stud high, stud eight or better, and then a no limit, 100, 200, no limit with a $15,000 cap. So it's a pretty big game, and it just felt right to skip the. There was a 1500 no limit that day, and that was the one day I had to skip the tournament.
Yeah.
So the 1500 tournament is that buy-in is not even one hand over there.
No, barely one third of a hand. I would say or something.
It's not even a big blind in the 800-1600.
Yeah. See, there you go.
Yeah. When you play the 8-game mix over there, are they all 8-game mixes, most of them?
No, this mix, the 8-16, was two studs and no limit hold'em.
Oh, so that's three all?
Games. Yeah, that mix. But every day it's different. It just depends on who's there and who wants to play what. And, you know, basically certain players dictate what we're playing, and there's other players like me that are willing to play any games and, you know, just want to make other people happy and enjoy themselves and have a good time in the
cash. But tell us about the negotiation involved in figuring out those games. I mean, you're pretty good at all of them, but you probably have a couple that you would much prefer to play, or you know, this guy's really a little weak in that. I'm going to try to get that in the mix.
I've always had a policy of not getting involved in making decisions on what games we play. I help out other players that, you know, are friendly and want to play certain games, and I'll certainly side with them if they do a good job help me building the game. But I'm willing to play any game. I don't really prefer any one game over another. So I just want to make people happy so there's games all the time and keep the games running as much as possible.
Well, I love that attitude. We've had a few of the people have sat in the same place you're sitting, and they would say, well, there's such negotiation when you're actually trying to pick it because you may know this person is very poor in Raz or is not a stud player or is a stud player or whatever it happens to be, and it's one of those, well, I'll let yours in if you let one of mine in, and they've mixed them back and everything like that. What's your cap? Because we had Jennifer Harmon sitting there, and she said the more games, the better, because there's a more chance that I can find a weak spot in somebody. She doesn't want an 8-game. She wants a 10 or a 12-game mix on this.
Yeah, I agree with Jen. It's certainly better for the more games we have in the mix. It's certainly better for me. I'm not a specialist in any one game, so you know I'm pretty well-rounded as far as, I guess we play up to 15-game mix at some times. But,
15?
Wow. I'd say on average we play like a 7 or 8-game mix.
Yeah.
But there's times when we add more games, and it just depends on who's in the game. Basically, I'm always going to side with the amateurs. If the amateurs want to play certain games and the pros are insisting or being stubborn and want to play other certain games, I'm always going to side with the amateurs. They're always going to have my proxy, and that's just my policy.
I was going to ask if there's a game you won't play, but if you're playing a 15-game mix, I think Crazy Eights is the only game you're leaving out.
Pineapple.
Yeah, I just love poker. I love all the games, and it doesn't really matter to me any one game from the next, so they're all the same to me.
Now, you're going to play a lot of stud events here and a lot of mixed game events. We've asked a couple of other pros who are particularly stud specialists if they're upset that this year there's no 10K stud championship. They knocked it down to a 5K buy-in in the hopes of increasing entries. So with half the buy-in, they would need to get twice as many people in there to get the field, I mean the prize pool to be the same. But this year, the 5K stud event went from 126 when it was 10K to 145, which means that the prize pool is actually 40% less than last year. What's your reaction as a stud player?
It's disappointing. The thing is, I remember back in, I think, January or February when they announced the schedule and they said they're going to change a lot of the 10Ks to 5Ks in the mixed events. And at first, I was disappointed. I said, "Wow, that's going to, you know, it's going to be a lot more people in the tournament, which is good and fine. But it's going to be harder to win a bracelet, and the money's going to be less in the tournament." So I was a little disappointed. But then I thought about it for a few minutes, and I said, "Well, you know what? Maybe if it's 5,000, they're going to get a lot more players. The field's going to be softer. It might be harder to win a bracelet, but you know, it's going to be more money involved. It's going to be better equity in the tournament." So then I started thinking about it, and I thought it was a good idea. So I was looking forward to it this summer. Now we get here, and we didn't get many more people. You know, we got a 20% uptick, and there's a lot of disinterest in the tournament because it went from 10 to 5. So a lot of the players around, you know, weren't so eager to come play it because the prize pool wasn't going to be as big when we didn't get double the players. So I think the WSOP probably miscalculated. I don't blame them. I would assume they would have got more when they went from 10 to 5. So at this point, it's disappointing, and I'm pretty sure if all the 10Ks that are moved to 5Ks don't double up in players, they might go back to 10Ks next year. So, you know, they're always willing to make changes and try to improve things, and I guess if something doesn't work, you know, they'll just go back to where it was before. Hopefully next year we'll go back to 10Ks.
Well, that kind of leads into another question I have for you. They're always changing it. They're up to 61 bracelet events. They put in several different ones, like the mixed match that they had here this year. Were there any of those that you really liked? Of these new events, or something you think that they're missing the boat on and should have in there?
You know what? I like all new events, no matter what they are, because I always felt like that's one of my advantages in poker, when the structures change, especially like in no-limit tournaments, when you go from one-third annies of the small blind to one-half of annies in certain events like the 50K to one-quarter annies, you know, different. During a single no-limit event, you can have different differences in the structures, and you have to adjust, and you know, the better players are going to adjust to the structure difference. So when it's just a similar concept when they bring out new events to the WSOP, and it's the first time you're in an event, the first time it's being played, you know, the better players that adapt faster are going to do well. So I always like the new challenges and the new events. And you've got to give credit to the WSOP for always trying new things. And obviously they try so many new things every year, not everything's going to work out. And maybe going from 10Ks to 5Ks is one of those things that's not going to work out. And hopefully they see that and they adjust next year and go back to 10Ks.
Speaking of changes, I mentioned at the top that you finished fifth in the Poker Players Championship, the 50K buy-in eight-game mix last year. I'm sure you're going to play it again this year, but it's not going to be televised. It's not one of the three events that WSOP is putting on ESPN, which means that when you get to the final table, you won't have to switch to all no limit. You'll continue to play the eight-game mix. ESPN had insisted, if it's televised, we don't want to see the other seven games. They're just too confusing. There's too many graphics. There's too many cards. And the casual poker fan just doesn't get it. As a person who's playing in that event, what do you think of reverting to all eight-game mix from start to finish?
Well, I made the final table of the 50K twice. And the first time, both times it was on TV, but the first time it was eight-game mix at the final table. And that was the year, you should probably remember Scotty. It was me, Scotty, Eric Lindgren. Scotty was, you know, a little inebriated and made a
little
scene. So that I was at that final table,
or
too.
Or you being polite.
So that one was on TV, and it was popular because of the Scotty antics, but I don't think the games are so popular on TV.
Yeah.
So an eight-game mix at the final table is probably not best for creating viewership and getting more people to register for the tournament. So I would rather that the final table be no limit, because then it's easier to transfer to TV and we'll get more entrants. But they felt fit to televise, I guess, the one drop instead this year. So I'm sure next year they'll go back to televising the 50K and make it no limit the final table.
Does this give you an edge in the 50K, since it's going to stay eight-game mix? Because there might be some people who are getting in there who think, well, you know what, I'm really good at no limit hold'em. If I get to the final table, I'll have an edge because that's my game.
I certainly have a much bigger edge in the eight game mix than just strictly no limit, because almost everyone in the tournament's no limit specialists, and I'm not a specialist at any one game. I kind of just play all the games, so a lot of people would pick me as a favorite in an eight game mix much more so than a no limit. More just, you know, part of the group in the no limit field. But last year I got to the final table and it was no limit, and I felt like I was a favorite in no limit. So, you know. Who knows if I'm actually a favorite, but I felt like I was a favorite, so it doesn't really matter to me. I just want whatever's best for the viewership, whatever's best to bring more players to the tournament, and you know, no limit at the final table is probably that way.
All right. I want to branch off a little bit different, because we only have a limited amount of time. There's so many things I want to cover with you. across the country, poker is changing and increasing. It's now opened the first casino in Ohio. There's several different states up in New England that are considering or are expanding their poker. Where do you see this going, or how can we keep it going? This poker growth that's out there. I mean, look at Pennsylvania and how it's changed just in the last 3 years. You know, what's happening on the East Coast, and where's it going to go from here?
I really think at this point in poker in the United States, it's up to the players to grow poker. I don't think it's really up to the corporations and the casinos. I think the players got to start partnering up with casino live casino rooms and start doing the right thing and getting out there and promoting the game, promoting themselves, branding themselves, and getting people more involved, whether they want to start people by teaching them. For example, at Parks Casino a month ago, I joined up with Deep Stacks. They came into town and taught poker, and we taught a group of 20-some fairly new poker players to the game who absolutely loved it, and I got a lot of great response from them, and now they're playing tournaments or playing cash games. Some of them were doing that previously. Now they're playing bigger, you know, being a little more successful after a day of a boot camp. And we got to start doing more things like that and kind of branching out and getting more people involved in the game, because everyone that plays poker really loves it.
Same topic. We have a problem in poker. Right now, 95% of them, the players that sit at the table, are male. 3-5% in any given tournament are female. That's half the population of the U.S. that we're missing out on. How do we bring more women into this? There are some tremendous women players right now. Some of them I don't want sitting across the felt from me. But how do we make it more popular among that whole gender?
I don't know if it's a problem that women aren't so involved in poker. I think it's one of those things where, you know, women aren't really that involved in watching football. It's one of those things where it's more geared to a guy's mentality. It's, you know, guys are more competitive that way in general. And if you're not very competitive as a person, you're not going to really enjoy poker as much as people that are more competitive. So, you know, women seem to be more social and less competitive, whereas, you know, guys are the opposite. So I think that's key. But there's certainly a big percentage of the population that could be interested that are women and would enjoy poker very much. I know a lot of women poker players from the East Coast that play consistently, at Borgata, at Parks, every weekend. And, you know, it seems like, you know, in reality, women have more responsibilities than we do as men, so it's harder for them to spend 8 hours at a table. And it's just, you know, it's the reality of the situation. It would be nice that if there was more women in poker, and I think there's the women that are in poker, that are names in poker, the popular women players are doing a great job of promoting the game, so hopefully they continue.
So here's what I'm getting is Matt Glantz's message to women who want to play poker, geez. Be more irresponsible. that's what I heard.
Pretty much.
Let me tweet that. Matt Glantz says.
That'll go over well.
Now, that segues perfectly into what I want to ask you about, responsibility. Last time we talked to you, you were a member of the Standards and Practices Committee of the Epic Poker League, which is now bankrupt and didn't get to have its fourth event and isn't having its $1 million free roll, and you've withdrawn from that committee, although I don't know that the committee was anything you could withdraw from if it didn't exist anymore. Give us your take on the demise of Epic Poker.
It's unfortunate for the players, unfortunate for poker. It's, you know, it turned into something that could have been very good for poker, very good for the players, and turned into another black eye for poker. Unfortunately, I got involved. I thought it was a great thing. You know, I knew nothing about the financial situation of the company, and nobody really did. We had no expectations of them explaining to us the finances. But from what I understand, they felt like they were financed correctly for the first 2 years of existence, and something happened in December, January, which they were surprised about, and I'm sure we'll find out in the future in some kind of legal filings or lawsuits between the Epic Poker League and investors. So that something happened where the investors didn't come through with the money at that time. So it was kind of, they were blindsided. From their point of view, they were blindsided, and it didn't work out. The real shame of it is that if it was successful, it was like the best thing for all the professional players, because it was like a new mode where, instead of other places like the WSOP or WPT where they charged a rake and kind of, you know, didn't really give any perks to the players, they really just were taking from the players. The Epic Poker League was based on a model of giving to the players and really not taking anything. So, and I know they wanted to be successful. They weren't in there maliciously trying to rob us or take money. They never took any money from the player. All the players, all they did was add $1.2 million to the prize pool in three events and give us free rooms and free food and really tried to do the best for the players. So I feel bad for them, but I wish they had a better game plan. I wish they were more financially secure, and it continued. And it's not I guess it's not officially dead yet, but we'll find out soon. They're in reorganization bankruptcy, not final bankruptcy, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I guess there's always a chance in it, but it doesn't look very hopeful, to be honest about it.
And last thing I want to ask you about before we let you run off to play a cash game or a tournament or whatever you're doing, I know you're friends with Brent Hanks, who won the first event here, the not the casino employees event, but the event two, the $1,500 No Limit Hold'em that started on Memorial Day. You and some other friends of his showed up for his bracelet ceremony, but he didn't. Now, I happened to run into him at Vanessa Russo's party. And Phil Collins and I were talking to him about this, and Brent was saying, it's not that important to me. I didn't really care about that. And he said he had actually told Nolan Dalla, look, I'm not going to be there. I have something else to do. Are you shocked at that?
Yeah, we had no idea. I mean, we were standing there. It was me, Jason Mercer, Alan Barry, Scott Clements. We were standing there front row waiting for him to show up. And I think Seth was right there. He was waiting for Brent. And it just happened that all of a sudden they got a phone call. I guess they were calling Brent, waking him up and saying, why aren't you here? And he actually had said that he told someone at WSOP he's not coming the night before, so don't expect me.
Right.
And it just, I guess the message didn't get through. And he didn't let us know, so we were just standing there like.
But are you shocked that somebody would win a WSOP bracelet and then, I'm going to party and I'm going to sleep late. I don't care about that.
I actually was shocked from Brent because he's a great kid, a nice kid, and it's not like, he didn't mean anything by it, and you would think he would just want to be there because he knows all his friends would be there, cheering him on and have a good time. But he just didn't feel like it.
Plus, it was a hell of a story. He was down to two big blinds at one point, came back to win the tournament. Remarkable.
Crazy. Absolutely. But I that has to be a first. When was the last time somebody didn't show up to pick up their bracelet?
I can promise you if I win a bracelet this year, I'll be there.
Let me tell you.
To enjoy the next day.
Yeah. Security couldn't keep you off the stage, right?
That's for
me
sure.
Either.
Matt Glantz, thanks so much for coming back to the Final Table. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Take care.
All right. That's our show for this week. Remember, you can download all of our shows, all 177 of them, available on our website, finaltableshow.com. And if you're not subscribing yet, you can download it automatically if you do it via iTunes or Stitcher. For Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. We'll talk to you again next week on the Final Table Poker Show.